This interview is for the Veterans History Project with Margaret Rose Foster Henderson, who served as a Navy Communications Intelligence Officer and a Naval Air Transport Officer from July 3, 1943 to October 14, 1946, obtaining the rank of Lieutenant JG. My name is Harriet Williamson. Also in the studio is Henry Radcliffe, the Director of Lighting, Sound, and Video Recording. Today is Tuesday, October 2, 2007, and we are in the television studio of WILL on the campus of the University of Illinois in Urbana. Mrs. Henderson, you were on a three-month school trip in the 1930s in Europe. Would you like to begin this interview and talk about that trip?
Yes, I'd be glad to. I grew up in Concord, Massachusetts, and my school had a school trip of the summer of 1936. And we went to a number of countries, but we spent 3 days in Berlin in 1936, and I attended the opening of the Olympic Games. And at that time, I saw Adolf Hitler in person and saw that he wouldn't shake Jesse Owens' hand when he won his race. And I happened to also be at the edge of a road that same day, and he came along in a touring car. And that evening, we had been billeted or stayed in different homes in Berlin, and the family that we stayed with happened that night, took us into a room and closed the doors and told us that terrible things were going on in Germany and that their own children, who were in the Hitler Youth, would turn them in if they found them telling us. But they asked us, there were three of us in this house or apartment, to go back to the U.S. and tell them that dreadful things were going on in Germany. And I think that stayed with me when I went to college at Radcliffe College my senior year. In the middle of the year, a number of us were recruited, women were recruited to take a communications course. It was secret and in cryptanalysis, and I happened to be a history major. Why I was recruited, I don't know. But I took the course, and if we took the course, we were offered either or assured that we would get a commission in the Navy, or you could go in as a civil servant. But we had agreed to enlist then, I suppose. Anyway, I took the course and spent a month at Mount Holyoke in officers' training. We were supposed to spend 2 months, but the war was heating up, and so they wanted us in 1 month. So some of us became what's called 30 Days Wonders, and I became an ensign and was sent to Washington, D.C. There I was assigned to the to Communications Intelligence Office, and I was very lucky to be put in the top European theater part where I didn't have to do decoding. But my job there was to keep track of the German U-boats, and at that time, that was 1943, the U-boats, the Allies were beginning to get a hold of the U-boats. They were sinking shipping right and left, but we had captured one of their codes, or had broken one of their codes, the Triton code, so that the communications from the U-boat skippers was being intercepted. I think at the same time radar had been perfected. But anyway, my particular job in that office was to keep track of the German U-boats, and we had German translators in our office. The decoded messages from the U-boats giving their position, longitude, latitude, were wired right into that office, and the German translator then took the decoded messages and handed me message. And then I took the pins. I had a huge map taking, covering the Atlantic from Stavanger, Norway to the Indian Ocean, and every U-boat a pin I had to move depending on where they were. And I did coordinate that with aircraft results or aircraft sightings from both British and U.S. airplanes. So all that information comes in, and I keep track of the map. And then that information actually was given directly to operations, and operations then sent out planes or whatever to go after the U-boats. Our office was completely secret, top secret, ultra. We worked on 24 hours a day, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 3 weeks, shifts, 8 to 4, 4 to midnight, midnight to 8 in the morning. The Naval Intelligence Office was located on Nebraska Avenue in Washington, and we never could tell any of our friends or anybody what we were doing. So that was pretty much my job until the U-boats were defeated. And then, let's see, I think that was around 1945. So then I decided I wanted to see something of the real Navy, I called it. And so I asked to be transferred to Hawaii, but there was no need for women communications officers in Hawaii. So they sent me, then I thought, oh, the Naval Air Force would be interesting. And I was assigned to the Naval Air Transport Service, the Atlantic Wing, which the Naval Air Transport Service had a run from Newfoundland down to Jacksonville, Florida. And I trained as an air transport officer, and I was sent, the Patuxent River, Maryland, was the head of the quarters, and they had two detachments. Norfolk was one, and I was assigned to the Naval Air Station at Norfolk. And there I was until the end of the war, and it ended up that I was in charge one day of the whole detachment because people were beginning to get out in 1946. And they begged me to stay in the Navy, but I didn't see any future for women then. So I was terminated, I think in August of 46, but I had, my actual date was October, so I was able to take a terminal leave, and at that time I could fly on any naval planes I wanted to. And a couple of places I went, which are sort of interesting today, I caught a trip to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, stayed there a couple of days, came back, and then I thought, oh, I haven't seen Havana, Cuba. And I found another Navy plane going to Havana, and I went there and stayed a few days. I did this with a friend, and so on. So, and then on, October 14th, 1946, ended my service, 3 years, 1 month, and 21 days.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what a naval air transport officer does? What was your job?
Well, a naval air transport officer was really in charge of the plane, the complete plane when it came from the last stop. Like going south, it would go Patuxent to Norfolk. And so when it came into the Norfolk airfield, it was loaded with, there was a load and balance sheet, and it was loaded with material going south, and the gas, what they call topping the rears, the gas tank. Allegedly, the air transport officer was in charge of all that to make sure the load and balance sheet was correct and that the plane was gassed up, and then he went out on the tarmac and said it was okay. You signed the balance sheet, went out and and told the captain of the aircraft, you saluted him, and he took off. Of course, it was really the Navy chiefs that did most of the work. I mean, the officers were in charge, but the Navy chiefs were the ones that really were the experts on the load and balance, because you had to balance the plane correctly.
Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of materials were being carried by these
all planes? Kinds of supplies. Mm-hmm. We never saw them. Mm-hmm. We also operated, or the Air Transport Service at the time, operated a shuttle between Norfolk and Patuxent River, and that was very popular with, if you could get a ride. I mean, it went by depending on what your status was. Some was official, some was, if there were a few seats left over, anybody that wanted to hitch a ride. Mm-hmm. And I was often in charge of the shuttle, and all kinds of sailors and whatnot mm-hmm. had stories about sick grandmothers they had to get on. It was sort of fun. And then Gene Kelly came once to our it was quite a stir, came to our airfield, and I have a picture somewhere of him. Mm-hmm. That he's in. And I think, some of the actors that were performing with the troops at that mm-hmm. time.
Now, when you were in the intelligence part, did you have, were you working constantly? So every day you would be involved in?
7 days a week.
Okay.
Yeah.
And was there a feeling of urgency while you were doing that?
Yes. But you see, but 40, I think it was 40, well, I've actually, we had broken the code in 42, so by the time I got in, or started work in July of 43, the convoys in early 43 were going after the U-boats, and the radar had been perfected, and so that the Allied sea power was beginning to slam the U-boat fleet. So when I got in, the urgency wasn't quite as high as it would have been. And I think it was another year. Well, yes, there was a lot of immediate urgency because we still didn't know how things were going to go. Mm-hmm.
What was it like working in Washington, D.C., which was probably the headquarters for all the war efforts?
Well, we got our own quarters. They didn't have enough quarters for all the military in Washington. So we had, some of us had an apartment, and then some of us that knew each other rented a house in Washington, Chevy Chase Circle, five of us. And it happened to be owned by well, he wasn't a mafia person, but sort of a rather criminal type. But his sister ran it, and they tried to get us out. See, it was rent control, and he thought he was going to get us out. But we all dressed up in our uniforms and went to court and won our case. Mm. It was sort of fun. He didn't have a chance. Well, no, he never appeared, but we heard he was quite a criminal figure in the mm-hmm. underground. No, living in Washington at that time, it was full of military people working and so on. And in our off time, we tried to have some fun and go to restaurants mm-hmm. and things. But it was pretty much work, because you would. But our house. It was interesting. There were four waves and one civilian, and one of the waves, who also had been a classmate at Radcliffe, was in the top Pacific Theater, and which involved Japan and everything. But we could never communicate. Mm-hmm. None of us ever said a word about mm-hmm. anything. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, there were not that many women in the military. Did you have any feelings of being special, or that this was an important mission, given that
No, I think we just realized we were placing the men on shore. I mean, mm-hmm. so they could go. Oh, and we just felt that we felt important that we were mm-hmm. doing something. Later on, as I mentioned, I didn't feel there was any future at the time for women.
Why did you feel that?
I don't really know. I just felt that. Let's see.
Did you face any discrimination, do you think?
No, I don't mm-hmm. remember any. Mm-hmm. I just in speaking with people and everything, and going up, I think the men had the higher posts and everything, and it was pretty much male dominated.
Mm-hmm.
There were some women that stayed on. It just wasn't something that interested me.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you attended any reunions of
any reunions?
Mm-hmm.
No. Interestingly enough, I've never heard from anybody. You see, that being in that particular naval intelligence group was very different than mm-hmm. being on a warship or being, and never have had mm-hmm. any communication with anybody. There were a number of math professors in our office. One rather famous one from Harvard, Van Norman Quine, I think he's dead now, but I knew him a little bit mm-hmm. anyway. But no, we never had any. And even in the air transport, I've never heard from anybody
mm-hmm.
or had any kind of reunions. I don't know of anybody.
Did the people that you worked with, be they women or men, do you think any of those people went into the intelligence service that followed in the Cold War?
I really don't know. Mm-hmm. I know that most of the officers were reserve officers, mathematicians. They went back to their colleges or institutions. Mm-hmm. There was a regular Navy man in charge of our unit, but I don't know. I don't know what he did.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, I'm sure some of them did, but most of the reserve officers went back to their civilian jobs.
Mm-hmm.
One was head of the Fogg Art Museum at Harvard. I mean, they weren't likely to stay in because
mm-hmm.
they already had
mm-hmm.
good jobs or fields. And the only people I ever heard from were my roommates in the house. I mean, but we were all in different areas
mm-hmm.
in touch. But no, never had any reunions, never heard anything. I don't even know what our unit would be called, technically,
mm-hmm.
because everything was so secret.
Can we go back to 1936 and to Germany? You were, at that time, around 15 years old.
Right.
So when you had people telling you about terrible things were going on in Germany, and when you go back to the United States, could you talk about that? Were you able to take that in because you were quite young?
No, I just turned 15. I mean, uh-huh. 14. I was a very young, naive uh-huh. 14. No, I think the East Coast, however, probably was a little more aware of what things were going on, because I can remember at my school we began to get a few refugees coming from Europe that
mm-hmm.
were getting out, families that saw, and some of them Jewish, of course, but and I think people were a little more aware of what was going on. But you know, if you tried to, I mean, as a 14 or 15 year old,
mm-hmm.
I'd tell people, I told my parents, anybody I could, but mm-hmm. it wasn't much I could do.
What was your parents' reaction?
Well, I think they understood, but you know, no, it's sort of like, you know, what can you do?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what can I do today to stop the war in Iraq? I feel helpless.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's because we're not in a position of power
mm-hmm.
of any kind. And I suppose, It's hard to think back. It's so long mm-hmm. ago. But I think most of us knew something was going on, and the group of us that had been on the trip were well aware that, I mean, that things in Germany were getting worse. You could mm-hmm. tell. I mean, there were military people all around, and even when we'd cheer at the Olympic Games those first couple of days, German guards would come down and tell us to be quiet. Mm.
When you were cheering for
yeah, we'd
the
all
US
sat
team.
Together. Yeah, we'd cheer for American runner, and the German guards up and down the stadium. They'd come down and tell us to be quiet.
Hmm.
They didn't want us to cheer. Of course, none of us bothered. You know, it didn't bother us that much.
Mm-hmm.
Although, if you really want to know a little more, the tour was run by a man named Mr. Tofern, who had been a German. And I think the Nazis were a little suspicious. You know, they're beginning to harass outsiders. And when we got to Garmisch-Partenkirchen on our way from Berlin, I was arrested in the youth. We stayed in youth hostels, and I was arrested by two men, I wasn't taken to a police station, but they grabbed me and brought me in a room and started speaking German. And my German was very poor, so I was very indignant. And the head of the tour, Mr. Tofern, came, and what he found out was that some young man there had accused me of stealing money. Well, the whole thing was ridiculous, because when it came to what time and where, I had been with six other people at a little concert. It was obviously a jumped-up thing. And, of course, mm-hmm. I thought it was a lark. Of course, mm-hmm. it would have scared other people, mm-hmm. but I didn't know any better. But it was interesting that the sum of money I finally found out that I was supposed to have stolen was 95 cents. And then the next year, I think Mr. Tofern was foolish, but he took another group in 37, and I was told that on that tour, one of his group was arrested for murder. That's what I heard. So obviously the Nazis were harassing, mm-hmm. and I think because he was German, they were harassing our group,
mm-hmm.
and he'd come to America. I don't know, but for me it was sort of exciting.
Were there any other inklings of war in the other countries that you visited on this trip?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I was thinking back about that, and certainly not in England at the time. See, we stayed in youth hostels except for Paris. We stayed in a hotel. Berlin, we stayed with inhabitants. That's how we happened to be.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so.
When you came back to the United States, was there any report about the Jesse Owens and Hitler not shaking his hand?
Oh, yeah. It was in all the newspapers mm-hmm. that Hitler wouldn't shake his hand because he was black.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we'd seen it, so we thought that was the opening day ceremonies were really interesting because all the nations paraded and they had, you know, they brought the eternal flame first. And what we particularly were interesting to watch, which nations wouldn't heil Hitler.
Uh-huh.
See, as they marched along in groups mm-hmm. today, so much more, it was simpler in those mm-hmm. days in the mm-hmm. stadium. But as nations went around, they heiled Hitler, the ones that were in favor. And so, of course, the Americans didn't,
mm-hmm.
the French didn't, the English didn't, but there were many nations that hiled Hitler.
Mm.
And when I was at the roadside, I don't know whether I'm imagining all this, but I looked around and all these Germans around me looked like they were in a trance, and they were all hailing Hitler as he walked by, and they mm-hmm. all seemed like they were and I may be, you know, it may be partly my fancy, but I felt that they were sort of, I don't know, in a daze.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked around, they were all hiling, and I thought, this is ridiculous. But you see, it, you know, being 14 and on the young side of a 14.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you would like to talk about that trip?
I can't think of it okay. right now.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to talk any further about your military service or your recruitment into the military?
Well, there isn't much to say. I feel that I had a very good experience. It was good, very good experience. I felt it was, I guess we all felt, World War II, that it was a necessary war. I don't approve of war at all. And as I told you, I've been watching Ken Burns, and if anybody thinks war is a terrible thing, and I really don't approve of invading countries. I've made that decision just mm-hmm. to go to war, or just to gain power, or mm-hmm. to gain territory, or oil fields, or whatever. I think it's senseless.
How do you think this experience influenced your life?
Well, I think in a way, it solidified my feeling that war is not the way to improve the world. I'm very anti-war now, and I don't think it solves anything. Mm-hmm. I think we somehow have to get along. We have to use diplomacy, and I don't know whether there's much hope, but I'd like to think we could someday. I don't know.
Now, before you left the Navy, you were able to do some traveling, and one of the places that you traveled to was Cuba. What was Cuba like at that point in time?
Well, I went, you know, Guantanamo Bay was a regular Navy base, and the few days there, I stayed in the bachelor officer's quarters and looked around the vegetation, and it was interesting. But when I went back and went to Havana was a very exciting, bustling city, lots of fun. They had high li. We stayed in the Hotel Nacional, which is a famous hotel. People were very friendly. This was before Castro. Mm-hmm. I never even heard of him at that point. So it was just a lot of fun and interesting, and people were happy. And we stayed 3 or 4 days and had a wonderful time. Went to a high li match and whatnot.
Did you do any other traveling during your time in the Navy?
Well, at the end, my terminal leave, I took advantage of the Navy planes. I could travel on any Navy planes, depending on priority. And so I took a trip to the West Coast and San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco, where my brother was, a sailor. Mm-hmm. He was younger than I am, but he had finally gotten in. And I had a nice trip because we'd stop at different places. Like on the way out, we stopped at various cities I'd never been, Tucson, Arizona, and so on. Wherever there was a naval base, mm-hmm. you could stop and either spend the night and they always had a place for bachelor officers' quarters. Later on, I stayed in the Naval Reserve, but once I had a child, I was put out.
How long were you in the Naval Reserve?
I don't know the exact date, but when I had my first child, it was 1949, mm-hmm. 48, and I was just getting a promotion, but at that time, now the Navy, of course, having a child is not, mm-hmm. you're not, but that was the end of that. So I'm a little envious of some of my male friends who still had all the privileges. They stayed in the Naval Reserve and they have a nice pension, mm-hmm. and they can travel on naval aircraft mm-hmm. if they want, mm-hmm. and have all the amenities. But the women, no. If you got married and had a child, you were out. I don't know when that changed. My husband always said I should sue the Navy, and I kept telling him I'm too old to sue the Navy.
Well, do you think that women's status improved as a result of their service in World War II?
I presume it did, yeah. Women's status improved all over gradually. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think it was just in the services. I would say it's just improved in general, mm-hmm. in all walks of life. I have friends now who are still very women's lib, but I do think women are pretty much pretty equal now, mm-hmm. in rights and whatnot.
Is there anything that we have not talked about during this discussion that you would like to mention or elaborate on in terms of your service or the mood of the country or your travel experiences?
I think I've pretty much covered everything I can think of at the moment.
Okay, well, thank you very, very much for being with us today. We certainly appreciate it.
Thank you.